Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Quickness and her friendliness, her commitment to women's issues even then. Since that time, she has gotten her master's degree in English from the U of U and is now a PhD candidate at Johns Hopkins University with an emphasis on narrative theory and feminist criticism. She has published several articles, is a regular contributor to Sunstone, has taught English and journalism in the secondary schools and at BYU, the Salt Lake Center. She is married and has three children and is eminently qualified to write about subversive messages in women's discourse. She will be responded to by Lori Winder Stromberg, who comes to us from L.A., is the managing editor of the Journal of Modern History, co-editor with Jesse Embry of a forthcoming book on women in polygamy, and is in her own way eminently qualified to respond to Doris's comments paper. So we will hear now from Doris. Get through the obstacle course and get up here. Not long ago, I was sitting in a Relief Society testimony meeting, and I was surreptitiously working on this paper, as a matter of fact, when an old woman in her 90s stood to speak, and she began by saying, "You know, Relief Society has always been my favorite meeting. In here, we're our own boss." And that comment really struck me, because what I'm interested in and what I'd like to talk about today is women's access to power in the LDS Church. Many lately have looked at the subtle demoralizing messages that are given to women by church publications and speeches. My own paper last year on the form of the Mormon conference talk is an example. Nicole Hoffman's analysis of young women's manuals, which was published in Sunstone. Levina Fielding Anderson's look at the visuals used in the Ensign. There are lots of examples, and some others that have been presented at the symposium this year. Today, however, what I focus on is women's own discourse and the subtle ways that they assert and reach for power. Now, this approach parallels the women's movement in general. As feminist historian Carolyn Luger explains, after the first stages of feminist awareness, we relinquished woman as victim for women as agents of change. And our previous examination of women's debilitating limitations has given way to an exploration of their persisting power. Since signs of reaching for power are what I'm looking for in women's discourse, I would first like to make a few observations about the concept of power. Women's relation to power has been a concern for a very long time. In 1845, for example, Sarah Ellis wrote in The Daughters of England, which was a manual for women, she writes, "Women in their position in life must be content to be inferior to men. But as their inferiority consists chiefly in their want of power, this deficiency is abundantly made up to them by their capability of exercising influence." While feminists now reject Ellis's contention that exercising influence makes up for lack of direct access to power, they do recognize that even when women are considered inferior and weak, unfit to control or participate in the events of the world, they still make their presence felt in a powerful way, as do other oppressed groups. In a book entitled The Power of the Weak, Elizabeth Janeway explores some of the various meanings of the word power. She suggests that the oldest common and generally male definition of power is dominance or control over others who are necessarily submissive. Another definition, however, equally old, is power as capability, competence, and energy. Berenice Carroll describes this kind of power as the capacity to assert one's will over one's body, one's own organs and functions, and over the physical environment, a power which is seen as inherently satisfying and not merely an instrument to other ends. This kind of power, she continues, neither requires nor leads to the power to command obedience in other persons. By this definition, then, power can be seen as a form of self-definition or self-rule. It could also be described as a sense of autonomy, a realization of the right to make choices, and the ability to act on situations, not merely on individuals. Janeway claims, for instance, that the fact that women today have the sense that they can step out of traditional roles, even though that it may be very difficult and they may choose not to, marks a very big change in our society and gives women a sense of power that they have often not felt in the past. I would add to Janeway's definitions another, which I relate to the sense of power as capability and autonomy, and that is spiritual power, the power to make contact with God and to use that influence to bless oneself and others. Yet another definition of power, however, and the one that I want to focus on more specifically, is power as the control of language. Not only do those who exercise this power regulate who will speak, that is, which voices will have authority and which won't, and what will be spoken, they also have appropriated the right to define the elements of our world and to declare how weighty, how urgent, and how pressing they are. This kind of power has been traditionally, including in the LDS Church, been lodged in the male hierarchy. It is the priesthood who has the power to speak for God, to set roles and determine policies, to give or not give weight to certain functions, to censor what others may say or write, and with a few exceptions, even to speak at all in our most public and weighty meetings. But power is not only the province of the overtly powerful. As with work on the lower classes, slave populations, and peasants, says Natalie Zeman Davis, work on relations between the sexes makes the location of power a trickier business than when one is looking at governments, parties, factions, and clientage systems. Power can lodge in dangerous nooks and crannies, but it is nonetheless there. Manifestations or assertions of power by the weak in language are hidden, disguised, covert. So much so, in fact, that they may not even be recognized by the speakers themselves. My mother, for example, who is a very bright, articulate, talented, but orthodox woman, would probably be very, would probably not be happy to say, have me say, especially in such a public setting, that it was she who taught me to be a feminist. But it is true. And it is women like my mother who, for many years now, have been invisibly but forcefully using subtle power strategies to undermine the force of institutions which define them as other, as inferior, as different, or as less powerful. Although it is the larger feminist movement and the few Mormon women who have participated in it openly who have forced issues of women's lack of power in the church to the surface, alone they cannot and could not motivate the changes they seek. But joined with the quieter voices of the more moderate and even conservative majority of LDS women, a message is getting through. It is also these quieter women, often unaware of their own power, who have helped to bring us to the stage where we are today, a stage where even LDS women do have choices, even though they may be encouraged not to take advantage of them or may choose not to, and where small but important concessions are being made to subtle and gentle demands for more participation in decision-making and public speaking, where at the very least, women's issues have become so insistent a force that they can no longer be ignored, even by those who are made most uncomfortable by recognizing them. Thousands of women like my mother, intensely loyal to the church and its leaders, have been speaking covert messages of women's power for years. Those few women who have chosen to speak openly, the most notorious, of course, is Sonia Johnson, have, by speaking out, actually lost their voices and been reduced to silence by the endangered ruling body. In finding their voice, that is, they lose it. But those women who speak in more veiled and palatable voices also have their impact. By losing their voice, they find it, or at least preserve it. They embed their own story in the midst of the orthodox one, what noted feminist critics Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubar call a palimpsest, something whose surface design conceals or obscures deeper, less accessible, and less socially acceptable levels of meaning. The women authors which Gilbert and Gubar speak of manage the difficult task of achieving true female literary authority by simultaneously conforming to and subverting patriarchal literary standards. Many Mormon women have done likewise. Well, what are some of the strategies for embedding such subversive messages in conventional discourse? And what are the subversive messages? I would like to demonstrate by analyzing a talk given by Pat Holland at the 1987 BYU Women's Conference. It was her talk, in fact, that, shall I say, inspired me to write this paper. I also, however, looked over talks and articles by dozens of other women which were printed in the Ensign over the past 12 years. I had to clean out my attic prior to moving to Baltimore, and sorting through all these, I read page after page of articles and essays and stories by women. These pieces of women's discourse were often bland, always uplifting, sometimes inspiring, and primarily represented the Mormon angel of the house. But here and there, in almost every talk or essay, even the most conventional, was a spark of rebellion, of assertion, a mark of hidden reaching for power and validation, a claim to spiritual power, or an assertion of autonomy. This was done in a variety of ways. As Susan Staker pointed out in her talk at last year's symposium, one common strategy is to say something potentially risky or suspect in the voice of another, especially some revered woman of the past. Staker herself used this strategy in an Ensign article entitled These Three Women, a historical piece about three early Relief Society presidents, one of whom goes against the advice of her missionary husband and continues teaching school so that she can, quote, remain independent as long as I possibly can. Others, like Staker, Jill Mulvey Durr, Mari Nirsenbach Beecher, Linda Newell and Val Avery, and many others, have also made potentially dangerous statements about women in the voices of historical speakers. But the same strategy is also practiced by women in official positions in the church, like Barbara Smith and Ardith Kapp. Kapp, for instance, uses as an example of exemplary young womanhood the story of the unsinkable Molly Brown fighting with her brothers and refusing to be defeated by them. In her symposium talk, Staker also talked about endings in women's fiction. As she said, how do you get your story told when there's only one way to tell the story? One way to do it is by simple volume. Though in an official church setting, the story of a woman's frustration and anguish over the limitations of her traditional role must have a happy, inspirational ending where she finds peace in the gospel, still, three-fourths of the story has not been about the inspiration, but about the frustration. And that leaves its mark, even though muted by the ending. Let me turn now, however, to Holland's talk. I would like to list and briefly discuss some of what I call hidden subversive messages and strategies that she employs, perhaps unconsciously, in this talk, given at a very sensitive moment. It was the keynote address at a conference with the theme of unity and diversity among women of faith, only 2 weeks after President Benson's fireside talk to the mothers in Zion. In this rather delicate situation, Sister Holland's job was to answer the hunger of many women who had come seeking validation of their worth and personal power as women, while at the same time not saying anything that could be interpreted as going against the prophet. And keeping with the theme of the conference, Sister Holland's talk focuses primarily on the idea of unity. This, of course, would seem to be a very safe subject. Church leaders, male and female, have preached unity over and over since the church was first formed. Sister Holland herself, in fact, has preached on this text before. Very safe. Women should be united, should be tolerant of each other, should share in sisterhood and service. But unity has another meaning as well. Even Jesus preached that a house divided against itself cannot stand. Those in power have always known that one of the most effective ways of defusing rebellion is to divide the rebels against themselves. When Sister Holland pleads with women to be united, she is, yes, asking them to feel the joys of sisterhood, but could she also be asking them not to let the power they have, the advances they have achieved, dribble away in bickering and name-calling? Incidentally, that's exactly what happened in a panel in which I was involved later in the conference. The pent-up hostility and frustration which many Mormon women feel was let out with an almost frightening intensity, but directed at each other and not at the sources which caused the frustration. Women who had met to gain strength from each other, to get new ideas for increasing their power to cope and achieve identity, instead ended up fighting each other and resisting the potentially enabling sisterhood offered at the conference. When Sister Holland calls for a community of women, she echoes women through the ages who have found such communities enabling in the midst of the most appalling oppression. But that is not all. Sister Holland also describes direct revelation to a woman, herself, appropriates scripture addressed to males, claims to have conversed with God spirit to spirit without any intermediating veil, and asserts her potential power to walk on the water with Christ. She explicitly deplores stereotyping of women and their roles, defends single women against charges of selfishness, protests the difficult condition of young mothers, claims the right of choice for all women, invokes mother goddesses at length, both Mother Eve and Mother in Heaven. She disputes the inherent and exclusive value of sewing, cooking, and canning skills. She invokes Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique, and debunks the angel in the house myth of the 40s and 50s. She also finds powerful female role models in the scriptures, ascribes notions of women as second-class citizens to Satan, and urges women to seek their personal identity. Sound like a revolutionary talk? Not at all. Sister Holland's talk is and was acceptable and palatable to everyone, including the priesthood authorities sitting on the stand with her. As far as I know, there have been no negative repercussions from the talk, and it was even printed in BYU Today. Not the end sign, I know, but close. Now, how did she do it? By using strategies of disguise and deception, as old as womankind. For example, Dr. Holland begins by telling us that even though she held an important leadership position in the church, her motherhood was always her first priority. She makes reference to her husband and praises him, and does the same with the brethren. She makes frequent references to her own weaknesses and maintains an entirely appropriate humility and feminine modesty. She uses Orthodox gospel language. The words faith, love, peace, and service come up frequently. She quotes scripture on church leaders, especially President Kimball. She blames the excesses of the women's movement on Satan and the news media. And she makes effective use of feminine vocabulary by using words like sweet, marvelous, sisterhood, we women, and images drawn from domestic activities. She invokes women's native compassion and inveighs against competitiveness. She speaks of the quiet triumph of faith and the inner strength to be gained. She also reveres motherhood and honors priesthood. But the most interesting moment of Sister Holland's talk to me, perhaps because it licenses what I'm doing right now, is when she explicitly asks us to look for deeper meanings behind the surface expressions. Describing how women can find female role models and validation of women's roles in the scriptures, Holland says this: we need to search, and we need always to look for deeper meaning. We should look for parallels and symbols. We should look for themes and motifs, just as we would in a Bach or Mozart composition. And we should look for patterns, repeated patterns, in the gospel. While Sister Holland may or may not be aware of what I read in her talk, she certainly is aware that there may be another message than the apparent one in any discourse, including her own, for those who read or listen closely enough to find it. And in this case, I believe the concealed message is an assertion of power, not necessarily power to dominate and control, but certainly the power of competence, ability, energy, and autonomy, and the right to spiritual power for women. Even Sister Holland's confession of weakness is, in a way, an appeal to women's power. For when she admits that she hates to sew and that she had difficulty coping with her glamorous church assignment, she gives other women the message that they don't have to live up to the image of the ideal woman, promulgated often by men, in order to be worthy. She strengthens the bonds of sisterhood by sharing her own experience of womanhood, an experience that may not be recognized or understood by those in power. As Janeway explains, what those who see their role as being in charge, that is, men, say about women has been filtered through their own heads. the position of women as described by orthodox axioms of power is certainly interesting, and we should be aware of it, but it is not the position of women as women know it. To publicly describe a woman's real experience is to subvert the orthodox prescription for women, and that is what Sister Holland has done. What she has also done very skillfully, as many of the brightest among the classes of the week have learned to do, is to walk that sensitive line between saying too much and not saying enough. She has preserved, perhaps even extended, the power of her own voice to keep on speaking, while simultaneously giving a strong message to those who were listening for it, and hopefully to some who weren't, about women's potential for power, both spiritual and temporal. Now, Sister Holland gave this talk to a group of women convened in order to listen to each other speak. The act of speaking itself is an act of assertion, and one that LDS women have taken advantage of whenever possible. The women have been, until recently at least, denied a voice in our most public forums. On the local level, their voices have often predominated. The larger part of the teaching done in the church is done by women, and many of the manuals written by them, though they have to pass priesthood inspection before being used. Close to half of sacrament meeting talks are by women. More than half of articles in church magazines are by women. And there seems to be an amazing number of freelance writers among the ranks of LDS women. A large majority of testimonies born in testimony meetings are by women. And even these opportunities to speak are being expanded. Women are now allowed to pray in sacrament meetings, and they may now, at least in many wards, speak in the powerful concluding position in sacrament meetings, and have even been allowed on occasion to speak in general conference. This latter, though mostly unheralded at the time, was a major advance, at least symbolically. And if its uniqueness was not mentioned by those presiding, it was certainly noted by the women who were given voice in that most public setting. Listen to the unspoken message in Elaine Cannon's conventional statement. It's a great thrill for me to stand at this pulpit in this tabernacle where I have come to conference all the years of my life. Unspoken, and I never imagined I would speak here myself. She repeats one sentence later, I am thrilled to have this part here today. That part is to be the first woman in anyone's memory to speak in general conference. President Barbara Smith marks the occasion even more vividly. And this is what she says. When I was a little girl, I participated in a program in the tabernacle. At that time, an impression came to me that I have never forgotten, even though I did not understand it then. I was filled with an awareness that sometime I would stand before a vast congregation of the church in this building. I thought this vision of my childhood was realized in the 1974 Relief Society conference when I was sustained as the general president of the Relief Society, but now I feel certain that this is the day I saw. This sounds so much like the stories we have heard of prophetic callings to young future prophets that it is quite startling. Sister Smith is asserting that God wanted her and told her he wanted her to speak from that pulpit, not just to women, but to the whole world. But ironically, such public occasions as general conference and even sacrament meetings, while most prominently displaying the church's willingness to give women a voice, are the ones which most forcefully constrict what that voice may say. Yet even in that restrictive setting, messages about women's power can be spotted. Cannon, after expressing her admiration and gratitude for her priesthood leaders and telling a little joke about holding the priesthood when he comes home to dinner, which is one of those strategies which women and other oppressed groups use to defuse risky issues by turning them into jokes, talks about able women leaders and, of course, strong priesthood leaders, but she conspicuously, against usual practice, lists the men second. Though her assignment has been with the young women, she talks of raising up people who will desire to make the holy covenants and keep them. She does not say the more usual girls or even young women. Barbara Smith begins her talk rather startlingly by comparing herself to a former Chief Justice, surely a veiled assertion of power and equality. She too praises women leaders and talks about the strength of our sisterhood, invoking specifically the Nauvoo Women's Monument as a significant historical moment. Especially read in the context of President Smith's other talks and interviews, an astute reader will recognize what a symbol that monument is to her and others of women's collective power to achieve something on their own initiative reminiscent of the earlier days of the Relief Society, when women raised money, built buildings, and published their own magazine. Thus, even in the very formal patriarchal discourse of General Conference, these women managed to weave in a message about the strength and power of women to lead, to achieve, and to accomplish. Of course, when women meet in their own meetings, they can be somewhat more open with their messages of power, at least the kind of power defined as competence and ability. So women get together in Relief Society, in women's conferences, in young women's meetings, in neighborhood chats, in scripture study groups, in home preschools. But isn't that just a segregation which further isolates women from power in the church? Yes and no. While such groups do separate women from the men who have more power, they also provide their own kind of power. Besides the support, encouragement, and identity such groups may provide individual women, they also operate in a way as female utopias, social organizations set up and ruled by women on their own principles of the way power should be exercised. As the old woman in my Relief Society said, we get to be our own bosses in Relief Society. Yeah. Anyone who has attended such groups has heard condescending remarks about the way men run things and felt the veiled but definite sense of superiority women feel about their own organizations. The lessons are prepared better, the physical atmosphere is more pleasant, and things generally run more smoothly and are better organized. Any woman in Relief Society can tell you that, although Relief Society may have other drawbacks for some of us. And the real Christ-like service which women perform, that is a matter for serious boasting. In a matriarchal organization, women's values, and I use that word in quotation marks, are validated, asserted, and acted upon. Both within the confines of their own meetings and also in more public settings, the value of the domestic and of the womanly is asserted over and over and over by the women who speak. Eileen Gibbons Kump, for example, speaking about her grandmother in a speech of the 1982 Legacy Lecture, says, "Grandmother's life had first attracted me as a writer because of the historical significance of her childhood in the United Order. That needed to be recorded. But aside from such historical significance, I began to see the beauty and disappointments of her life, the pulse of it, the heartbeat, the richness of it, and the power lay essentially in the little everyday happenings that formed its greatest part, soap-making day, gathering sand with which to scour the knives, forks, and spoons, and so forth." Kump's talk reminds me of something that I read in Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. She says, "But it is obvious that the values of women differ very often from the values which have been made by the other sex. Naturally, this is so. Yet it is the masculine values that prevail. This is an important book, assumes, because it deals with war. This is an insignificant book because it deals with the feelings of women in a drawing room." Both these women, along with thousands of others, want to claim equal or even greater validity for female domestic values as for masculine presiding and historical ones. A similar assertion is made by Elaine Shaw Sorensen, also one of the Legacy Lecture speakers. She quotes E.T. Sullivan, "We fancy that God can only manage his world with battalions, when all the while he is doing it by beautiful babies. When a wrong wants righting, or a truth wants preaching, or a continent wants opening, God sends a baby into the world, perhaps in a simple home and of some obscure mother. And then God puts the idea into the mother's heart, and she puts it into the baby's mind, and then God waits. The greatest forces in the world are not the earthquakes and the thunderbolts. The greatest forces in the world are babies." Now, while I have some objections to the notion of the mother as simply the uncomprehending conduit between God and the probably male baby, still, this is a typical assertion of the great power of women's work. And in the context of the talk, it is used to point out the need for women to be educated, another assertion of value for their work. It is not just instinctive, but requires intelligence and competence. The notion of a sort of women's utopia where women's values reign supreme is by no means unique to Mormon culture. It was an especially common theme among 19th century women. One of my favorite statements of this idea comes from Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. bestseller in the world in the 19th century, which has its own hidden message of women's power. While most readers assumed that Stowe's purpose was to depict the evils of slavery, that was in fact only one part of a larger scheme. Stowe actually conceived her book as an instrument for bringing about the day when the world would be ruled not by force, but by Christian love. And the force which would bring about this new world is motherly love. Critic Jane Tonkins describes a scene from the chapter The Quaker Settlement in Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I'd like to read a little bit of what she says. Have you noticed some of the things she says? In this scene, Christian love fulfills itself not in war, but in daily living. And the principle of sacrifice is revealed not in crucifixion, but in motherhood. The form that Stowe's utopian society takes bears no resemblance to the current social order. Man-made institutions, the church, the courts of law, the legislatures, the economic systems, are nowhere in sight. The home is the center of all meaningful activity. Women perform the most important tasks. Work is carried on in a spirit of mutual cooperation, and the whole is guided by a Christian woman who, through the influence of her loving words, gentle moralities, and motherly loving kindness, rules the world from her rocking chair. The woman in question is God in human form. Seated in her kitchen, at the head of her table, passing out coffee and cake, Rachel Halliday enacts the redeemed form of the Last Supper. Exactly what position men will occupy in the millennium is specified by a detail inserted casually into Stowe's description of the Indiana kitchen. While the women and children are busy preparing breakfast, Simeon Halliday, the husband and father, stands in his shirt sleeves before a little looking glass in the corner, engaged in the anti-patriarchal occupation of shaving. In the contemporary LDS church, such a utopia where women's values are the ruling force has to some extent gained institutional sanction. With the intense emphasis on home and family, the church gives doctrinal validity to the power of the domestic sphere, even if in practice the patriarchal activities of leadership and presiding still often retain more weight. Such a turn of events could be read as an attempt by men to gain more control over women in the domestic sphere. If, as has happened in the rest of the world, religion itself is seen as a women's concern, then men who are committed to a religion must fight to ensure themselves of their own virility by exercising such control. But this valorization of the home could also be read as at least a partial victory for women. Their own subtle, disguised, and hidden assertions of power and validity have achieved a quiet triumph. They have forced the males in authority to redefine experience in their own terms, terms which assign to women both value and power, at least as long as they stay comfortably put in that domestic sphere. Ultimately, however, the ghettoization of women, isolating them from the councils where decisions are made and policies are set down, except possibly for a few token spots on a committee, and confining them to exercising power only in groups of other women and children, is not good for any society. The powers of the weak are, Janeway reminds us, finally, more powerful than we think, and can only be ignored by the powerful at their peril. Combining into communities of their own has always been an important and even dangerous source of power for those without the power of dominion. The banding together to assert common experience, to share grief, guilt, sorrow, anxiety, and hope, binds the weak together in a way that makes the governing body very uncomfortable. And when they are uncomfortable, they act, often out of fear rather than reason or morality, or, dare I say, inspiration, to put the weak back in their place, to divide them from each other, to place unattainable ideals before them in order to emphasize their personal failure and weakness, and to take away any speaking voice which is too clearly dangerous. But martyrs have spoken, at least for a day, and others who choose rather to speak in disguise continue to be heard, even now in General Conference. The ruling body of this society is clearly uncomfortable. Pressures from without have combined with voices from within. Voices of fairness and reason from within some of the most powerful to make them uncomfortable. Responses to this nagging uneasiness vary. Those like myself and many others represented here today who feel women moving closer to the centers of power have begun to ask questions about power and its uses. For most women in the past and many in the present, such questions have not seemed very interesting. As Janeway puts it, what could our foremothers do about these matters? Thinking in a vacuum when you can't implement the conclusions you draw invites frustration. But the very fact that so many women are meeting in retreats and reading publications like Exponent 2 and attending sessions like this one demonstrate that questions of women's access to power are no longer completely closed. And the very defensiveness of many Mormon women, those who aggressively assert their right to make traditional choices and demand respect for those choices, is another clear indication that all is not as it was in Zion. Even though such women may claim not to want the power traditionally vested in male priesthood authority, they too are obviously unwilling any longer to accept a definition of women, even a subtly implied one, as weak, inferior, or lacking in the kind of power defined as competence, ability, and energy, or as not worthy enough or clean enough to approach God without male mediation to receive their own inspiration and revelation. That so many assurances of women's equal but separate status have been made by church leaders lately demonstrates that even those women whose consciousness is still embryonic are manifesting feelings of discomfort with conventional definitions of their place and role. Such women simultaneously support and resist existing power relations. On the other hand, many men who feel themselves, accurately or not, on the brink of losing their power, react forcibly out of their fear of the future. Understandably frightened of a world radically unlike the one they have known, some may seek to enforce idealistic visions of the past or reassert the benignity of their own administrations. After all, Father knows best. Changes which bring hope to some always bring disorienting confusion to others, especially those who are used to making the rules and giving the definitions of men, as men have always done in our culture. This does not mean that even the most reactionary are malevolent, misogynistic, or even necessarily insensitive. They may be merely victims of their heritage, shall we say in this case, the traditions of their fathers. Others of our leaders, of course, have reacted not so much by trying to reinstate the past, but by emphasizing the progressive nature of the church's response to women's issues. They will often cite, for example, the early church's support of women's suffrage, or reiterate their support for legal equality for women, always excepting the ERA, of course, or simply reassure women of their equal worth in the sight of God. But such a response, though more palatable, also disguises a resistance to change and an uneasiness about any upset in the balance, or perhaps I should say imbalance, of existing power. Nonetheless, the discomfort which lies behind all these reactions, I find a sign of hope, because it is that discomfort which motivates change, sometimes radical change, even revolution. Now, of course, it does seem strange to think of ordinary Mormon women, women who would recoil in horror at the thought of being spoken of in this way, as revolutionists. But not all revolutionists speak out because they are revolutionaries. They speak revolutionary words because of an irresistible impulse, perhaps not yet cognitively recognized, that it is the right thing to do. They feel truth, and though it may feel strange, they respond to it. Not all revolutions are violent or because a body wishes to be violent. They occur because a growing body becomes to understand that change is first right, then necessary, and when the body in power perceives this as well. Some among this body will fight the movement, but many will not. Truth and right have a way of wearing down artificial defenses in good people. The unease, the vague sense of perpetuating injustice, which many now live with or soon will live with, the sense and eventual realization that something out of sync with a righteous eternal plan sits oppressively on the church today, these impressions will grow in power as they are reinforced by wives, daughters, granddaughters, co-workers, neighbors, and teachers. It is critical that we as women continue to exercise our right to speak, taking it even when others attempt to silence us, as women in our church have always done, whether in the private settings where we may openly or more nearly openly speak our real stories, our real pain, and our real power, or in our homes where we can instill the truths we know and feel in the minds and hearts of our children, both female and male, or in using the powerful strategies available to us to speak our honest feelings, even in public. We must use whatever means we can find to tell our story. Women have not been, are not, and will not be silent or powerless in this church. It is my hope that someday women's real story, not just the authorized version of it, will be heard and seen, not through a glass darkly, but openly and clearly, when to speak aloud will not mean choosing silence, and revealing power will not be to lose it. A generation, perhaps more, may pass, but words will do their work, because in a church that is true, truth will always triumph. Thank you.
Is this a message that was left over? Oh. My comments are less a critique of Doris's paper than thoughts that I've had since reading it. I'm not an expert on rhetoric, merely a purveyor of it. And especially when it comes to women's issues, much less subtle in my approach than the women heretofore quoted. More on that later. In her paper, Doris recognizes that men in the church have appropriated the power to, and I'm quoting from her, set roles and determine policies to give or not give, weight to certain functions, to censor what others say or write, and with a few exceptions, even to speak at all in our most public and weighty meetings, indeed to speak for God, unquote. Focusing on Mormon women's discourse, she examines the subtle, even subversive ways they assert power within the male power structure. A structure, I might remind you, which, though it might allow small cultural concessions, is not seen as merely having an earthly function, but in our current theology is part of a divine patriarchal pattern. Our whole concept of exaltation is based on a male-centered, hierarchical, polygynous model, with women eternally left out of the formal power structure. Given the weight of this pattern, women's ability to assert their influence is confined to persuasion and always subject to presiding male priesthood authority. Doris unquestionably identifies subtle assertions of power in Mormon women's discourse and the strategies employed to assert it. I think Doris feels more hopeful about these assertions than I do, though my concern, and thus the focus of my comments, is with the strategies. As I said before, my general rhetorical style when dealing with women's issues has never been subtle. This has led to numerous debates between my husband and me, not because we differ necessarily in substance, but rather in method or strategy. My husband is the consummate diplomat, more abrasively to the point. I don't want to suggest that there is not a legitimate place for diplomacy. I think, rather, that my more direct rhetorical style is a conscious attempt to respond authentically to a way of communicating common among the powerless, namely manipulation in its various forms and degrees, some of which are understandable, many of which are dishonest and deceptive, and sometimes even reprehensible. When and wherever people are placed in a powerless position, they learn to manipulate in order to survive. In Doris's words, they employ, quote, strategies of disguise and deception as old as womankind. It is a sad and painful commentary on our society if Mormon women cannot be heard unless theirs is a properly deferential voice. I struggle with the problem of how to be effective in bringing about change while still maintaining my integrity. In thinking about this in relation to Doris's paper, some important questions emerge. Is the message ultimately undercut by the deferential posture? Does such outward deference with the occasional subversive comment really shake the status quo? Or does it help perpetuate it by allowing women to tolerate oppressive structures a little longer? I'm not sure how Doris would feel about this, but I think Sonia Johnson's abrasive voice is still reverberating. In her direct, public, overstated style, and I'm not really a Sonia-phile, but Sonia rocked the foundations of our patriarchal complacency, asking hard questions and forcing women's issues to be addressed because they could no longer be ignored. We might ultimately find that she had an impact more far-reaching than hundreds of subtle assertions of power cloaked sometimes unrecognizably in deferential voices. A few final points. Unlike Doris, I don't think current praise for domestic responsibilities is an indication that women have been victorious in getting male authorities to redefine experience in their, namely women's, own terms, but reflects a continued valuation of women within appropriate male-approved spheres. Secondly, my experience with Relief Society is that it is often not the haven for women's voices that Doris describes. Male definitions still persist, and male authority is constantly appealed to. This is my experience, because male voices predominate in our manuals and our minds. Let me give you just a few examples from the current Relief Society manual. First of all, and I have to admit, I've been to Relief Society about 3 times in the last year, and they were all lessons on priesthood and supporting priesthood. Tom said, you just pick the wrong days to go. Okay, the first is an extended letter to the writer's granddaughters on the legacy of women, written not by a grandmother, not by a mother, not by a woman, but by a general authority. The second is from a lesson on supporting the priesthood, i.e. male leaders. And it gives 2 examples, the appropriate example of support and the inappropriate. And I'll quickly paraphrase. Obviously, I'll be using my own language. because I want to highlight some of the hidden messages I think are in these 2 examples. The first is of the selfish woman. Apparently, she gets a tad bitchy because her husband is never home. And she has to do everything with the kids by herself. She has to get them to church by herself. She starts getting, as I said, bitchy. She wants him home. Well, of course, what this does is increasingly thwarts his church career and eventually ends in divorce and dissolution of marriage and breakup of the family, the whole thing. The second example given right after this, the good example, is the sainted mother of 7 who has a stiff upper lip, and yes, indeed, it is hard sometimes to get those 7 children ready for church and get that little, yes, even get that deacon off to priesthood when her husband is gone. But this is her reward. Her husband comes home late one Sunday night. They haven't seen him all day long. And he said, I was just in one of the most spiritual meetings of my life, and I have grown more spiritually tonight than in any other time in my life. Now, outwardly, I mean, it's not bad for a man to grow spiritually, but her reward is his spiritual growth. And to me, I'm sorry, but I feel so strongly about this. Besides being severely psychologically damaging to women burdened because of perpetually absent priesthood holders, the message in the latter example is a supreme assertion of the male-centered status quo. It warns that challenging the established order only invites disaster. In closing, I would like to respond briefly, hope you'll allow me this, to Jean England and Margaret Toscano. Remarks that are not entirely unrelated to my comments today on this paper. I'm not so unsophisticated or dead to symbolism that I can't think in terms of levels of meaning. My question to them is, when does a symbol, having been so tortuously redefined or drawn out, cease to function as an adequate conduit of meaning? In this paper, when does the method employed by the women quoted become the message? I suppose I'm a tad cynical. But I fear that truth will not always triumph, particularly when it's unrecognizable to any but an elite few or not at all.
We have about 8 minutes before the end of the hour, and we'd like to turn the time over to you now if you'd like to address one of these two women.
Go ahead, Jean.
We've been admonished to read more literature by Mormon women.
This was my. If I were a school teacher, I'd say, you guys weren't listening to me. I gave about four different definitions of power, and I don't think all the women who speak are looking for the same kind of power. I also am not advocating, in any sense of the word, that this is the way women should speak. And I think I tried to make it very clear that revolutions happen because of two forces. They happen because there are martyrs who speak out loud, speak honestly, and then are silenced because they are dangerous. But their voices persist and their message is heard. But if those voices speak out and no one agrees with them, no one listens to them, if all the rest of the people think they're crackpots, they do not accomplish their purposes. What I'm trying to say is that it takes both in order for change to happen. It takes people who speak out honestly, openly, abrasively, and take the consequences for that to bring issues to a head. But in order for change to happen, it has to be supported by the quieter majority. That's what's happened in the women's movement at large. That's what happened with the civil rights movement. That's what happens in every movement in the history of the world where change has occurred. There have been some who were radical, who spoke out, and there were hundreds, thousands, millions of quieter voices who say, maybe there's a tiny bit of truth in that radical that spoke out, even though I wouldn't have anything to do with that radical. And that influences the way they speak and the way they act, and those two forces working together are what it is that causes change. And as I expressed in my conclusion, my hope is that before long we won't have to speak that way anymore. But if every woman who wanted to speak a message about women stood up in the way Sonia Johnson did and got excommunicated, or stood up in the way Linda Newell did and was not allowed to speak anymore, pretty soon we'd all be silent permanently. Well, if all women did that, you're right, we wouldn't. But the point is, all women won't do that. There are very few women who are willing to take those consequences. And the reason that I am as aware as Lori or as any of the rest of you of the kind of debilitating messages that are given to women by the manuals, the talks, the way we're treated in so many ways. If you don't believe it, I'll give you a copy of the paper I gave last year. But what I'm trying to do this year is what I, in the beginning of my talk, I quoted a feminist historian who said that after the initial stages of the women's movement, when we continually focused on how picked on we are and how oppressed we are, we now have changed to look at women's persisting power, even women that other women despise for being weak and for being not brave enough to speak out. And what I'm trying to say is that those women who are not brave enough to speak out, or who may not even know they're feeling that, are also helping to cause change, and they should be valued too. And I think that
And I'm not saying they should be valued over those who speak out. I'm saying they have to work together. And when you want to talk about psychological damage, there's psychological damage done to women by being always told things about themselves in all those other forms. I think there's also psychological damage in women continually telling themselves how oppressed they are. I think instead we need to be telling women how powerful they are. Instead of always focusing on how those men are putting us down, let's focus instead on, at least some of the time, on how we can build each other, how we can strengthen each other, how we can work together and create change, see ourselves as powerful and as empowered and not always as oppressed. Because I think that is just as important a step in accomplishing change as recognizing the evils.
Our time is up. Thank you very much for coming today.